I wanted to continue where I began last week. For those of you who are new to today, we usually begin with questions, but I'd rather skip that today. In the future, we will have time for questions and answers. For now, because I want to continue with this teaching from Thich Nhat Hanh. I won't go into it. I don't know if they've been posted, the talks from last week, Alex. They're posted on the website?
I don't know about the website. They're uploaded.
They're uploaded, but they may not be on the website yet. So I began last week, again, because even though we've been giving teachings for years now, beginning here in our new home, I wanted to share these kind of this vision that Thich Nhat Hanh, that many of us look to as a founding spiritual mentor, and we derive great inspiration from him, I'm sure many of you do. But people are less familiar with this very interesting order called the Order of Interbeing that he established in the 60s when he was still in Vietnam. Himself and six young lay people, most of them were college students, involved in the School of Use for Social Service. So he founds this order called the Order of Interbeing, or Tiepien, and last week I spent a long time talking about actually what the words that he translated as interbeing, but actually have, anyhow, I explained that and spent a little time going over the beginning. And I'm doing that because I think it really, in this order of interbeing and the charter that he developed, which is usually we think of as a legalistic, the charter of, he really established his vision for 20th century Buddhism and engaged Buddhism, a Buddhism that is very much alive. So again, I will not go over some of the things that we talked about last week, since many of you were here last week, but either now or soon, they'll be available on the website. And again, I think I spent the whole hour on just this number two, which said the aim of the order is to actualize Buddhism by studying, experimenting with, and applying Buddhism in modern life with special emphasis on the Bodhisattva ideal. Am I right? So that's what we accomplished in an hour. So let me just continue on. It says the Order of Interbeing was founded within the Linchi school of Dhyana Buddhism. So basically in it, and again, we won't go into it today, Dhyana Buddhism is really a more formal way of talking about Zen. And the Zen, which in China was called Chan, which comes from the Sanskrit dhyana. Dhyana is the whole realm of a meditative practice. And so what was always unique about Zen, as opposed to many, many other schools and teachings of Buddhism, was its emphasis on direct experience, meditation, and awakening. As opposed to many other schools and traditions of Buddhism that have been founded in China, at the time that Zen was established, which put a lot of emphasis on ritual, devotion, study, dialectics, philosophy, et cetera, et cetera. The Zen put it directly back on this is about not just studying Buddhism, it's about becoming a Buddha. And that becoming a Buddha was not something extraordinary, mystical, only for the few, but in the sense that it means someone who wakes up to their true nature is something that's available to all of us. And then he says, very important, he said, it, meaning this new order he has founded, is grounded in four, he calls them four spirits. First is the spirit of non-attachment from views. Second is the spirit of direct experimentation on the nature of interdependent origination through meditation. Third, the spirit of appropriateness. And fourth, the spirit of skillful means. And he says all four to be found in all Buddhist traditions. And in this book, I'm reading from this book, Interbeing, third edition, there is some commentary that he did. And I just want to share that. So he says, when he says non-attachment from views, he says to be attached means to be caught in dogmas, prejudices, habits, and what we consider to be truth, capital T. The first aim of the practice is to be free of all attachments, especially attachments from views. This is the most important teaching of Buddhism. Again, I think since we are meeting here just a few days after the election, I think it is very meaningful that this is the first, and he calls this the most important. Because as we know, in elections, which is a representation of our politics, it's all about views, right? And it's all about my view is better than your view. It's all about I have truth and you don't, right? Dogma, prejudices, and all these things that are referred to are what it's about, right? I mean, there is very little attachment or discussion of facts, agreement on facts, discussion about facts, and looking at the facts of the situation that we're in as a community, as a country, to really openly share our various views, ideas about these facts, about these situations, and how they can be dealt with, right? And why does that lack of discourse, why does that lack of willingness to look deeply into situations and to come together, to talk together, and share together is why? Because of attachment to views. People think their views, their ideas about life are reality and are unchangeable truth. And when you, and whether you are running for president, running for senator, running for the House of Representatives, running from local issues, whether you are a parent in a home, whether you are somebody in relationship with another person, whether you go to work, whether you're in school, we know that we all have views, don't we? Views mean what? The way we see things, right? That's a view, right? And obviously, if I'm standing here and you're standing there, we may view things differently, right? Depending on the way my eyes see, depending on my background, there are so many variables that have to do with views. I would imagine people in this room, does anybody feel that the views they developed when they were children have, without a break, continued to be the way they view themselves and the world and everything to this moment? Is there anybody who says, my views have never changed one iota? No. And I would imagine there are many people who would say, wow, when I think of my views in the past, even I cannot help but notice how changeable my views are, right? And not only just about politics or religion or the big thing, but my views about people, right? There might have been people that at one time I viewed quite favorably that I began to view unfavorably. Right? And vice versa. My views on what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a parent, what it means to be a partner, what it means to be a citizen, right? My views of the earth, my views of food and eating and consumption patterns, and, right? Wow. So each of us know just for ourselves how changeable views are, how transient, how temporary. And yet we find, even though when we think about that, reflect on that, that becomes clear. And yet at the same time, we notice that in the moment, we are so attached to our view as if it is true. And we are willing to argue, we're willing to fight, we're willing to think all kinds of wonderful things about ourselves and all kinds of terrible things about people who hold alternate views. Whether it's the people we live with, people our neighbors, or, you know, to the biggest issues, right? It's amazing how attached we are to views. And yet when we are rational and reflective, we see how changeable they are, how temporary they are. So he says, the aim of the practice is to be free of all attachments, especially attachments to views. Now, it is a very important phrase here, which is the word attachment, right? Because we all acknowledge that we all are full of views, right? You cannot vote in the election without having views. You cannot watch the results come in without having views. You know, I view it this way, I know my neighbors view it that way, my relatives view it this way. I just talked to one of our members who's in Texas, and she says she has to be very careful about her expression of her views with her relatives there. It could get her in, could cause great conflict. So again, when we understand that all views are transitional and temporary and are subject to change, even though we may have views and views that we believe are true to us, right? Say, you see what I'm saying? True to us. This is, we're willing to say, this is my view. And this, in the moment, at this time of my life, is the view that I believe is the best way of looking at things. See, one can say that and at the same time understand that it is simply my view and is simply my way of looking at things, and it is not necessarily the true view, the only view. And so I can have views, but I can also be open to the views of others, right? Even my children, I can be open to their views. Because everybody has their own particular way of looking at life, putting it together because their own causes and conditions, and looking at things. And to be open to the views of others means that I am not turning my views into dogma, into truth. And we see how dangerous that is, because attachment to views and letting that become truth and dogma always lead to what? To suffering. Always lead to suffering. And we see that in this day and age where the capacity to do harm, the capacity to do violence, the capacity to use all various forms of media to propagandize views, the capacity of attachment to views to do widespread harm is, I think, much more prevalent in our modern day societies than it was in the past. And so therefore, if we want a society, as we all do, if we want a community, a culture, in which openness and diversity and mutual respect, you know, all these kinds of things, these environments that we would like to live in, we need to make sure that we begin with ourselves and to make sure that, you know, am I free of attachment from views? And in my community, in my spiritual community, am I sure that my spiritual community is free of attachment to views? So that is why, again, I think it's important that he says this is the most important teaching of Buddhism. It's most important because not only for the social ramifications, but again for the personal ramifications. Because if I want to live in openness, and I would imagine many people here say, yeah, I'd like to be an open person, right? You know, in the change of the weather, right? We've noticed we now have the capacity in Florida of opening our doors and windows, right? And having fresh air come in. We'll work on it here. But it's nice to have that opportunity to be open, right? Not to always have the doors and windows closed. So fresh air and fresh breezes and fresh odors can come in, and the house can air out. In the same way, I think, as human beings, it's good to be open. So we're always fresh. And to be open means, again, you know, that openness, that capacity, or let's say to be closed, also refers to all our senses, because when our eyes are really open, we see what is in front of us. When our ears are really open, we hear the sounds that are coming to us. And it's the same with all our senses. But if we have ideas about everything, right? If we have ideas and judgments and evaluations and views about everything that we encounter, everything we see, every person we see, everything we hear, everything we taste, everything we smell, we immediately have a view. Then all we're ever experiencing in life is what? We think we're experiencing life, but we're just experiencing our views about life. There's no openness. You know, there are many people who think they're open, but actually they're very closed because their openness is really just an openness to certain things, to certain ways of being. That's not real openness. So this practice of being open, especially open to the views of others. You know, I remember once when we were talking to people about communication, and you know, when you tell them, about accepting, the feelings of another person, accepting the view, the way somebody sees a situation that's very different than ours. And when I'd say that to people, they say, well, if I say to Mike, I can understand why you might see it this way or feel this way. Isn't that kind of a saying that they're right? And heaven forbid we should say anybody else is right but ourselves. But no, it's not that. Right? It's acknowledging that, yes, I can understand why you might see that way. I can understand why you may feel that way. That's not saying it's right or wrong and not saying that that's the way I see it. But at least it's acknowledging to the other person, I can understand you. Right? And I can understand what you're thinking and I can understand what you're feeling, because if I went inside you and if I saw the world through your eyes and if I had always lived your life, I would probably be looking at things the same way you are. Again, we all think that we are so special and unique, don't we? That is one of the arrogances of being a human being. We all think we're so special and unique, and yet actually, if we take an honest look, we will see we are just really the production of many, many causes and conditions and many, many variables that have come to create us. and that if we had grown up in totally different situations and had totally different experiences, we might be having very different thoughts, feelings, and perceptions than we do now. Again, that doesn't mean that we can't be who we are, in some sense. But that is who we are. But we don't see it as somehow it's truth. Okay? So living in a world where, you know, a Romney and an Obama can have different views about the economy and different views about the solution to social problems, but understand that they're just views, and also be, I mean, this is unimaginable, right? That you could possibly think that our leading politicians would go, you know, and I'm curious to see how you look at this situation, right? I'm just curious. And I'm just curious, and I see that's interesting that you have a very different solution to the economic problem than I do. I'm interested why you think the way you do. Can you imagine what it would be like if you turned on a debate and there was that kind of discussion going on? You know, that somehow I think that the other person is not a complete idiot. But somebody who thinks about things and comes and, you know, is concerned about the same problems that I am and maybe going about it in a very different way. And I'm curious about that. Rather than immediately dismissing anything that is differing from my view, and whether it's Romney or Obama, or whether it's us with our partners, with our children, with our relatives, with our colleagues, with our friends, we are doing the same thing. So, this practice of non-attachment to views is so important for a society, for a spiritual community, and for us as individuals. Is that clear? Are there any questions about that? I mean, if you do, please feel free to ask it. So, you know, it's very interesting where this is coming from. Because we know that most religions, when they state their most important thing, their principles, they would start out with what? What? Right, view. And why you must have this view. It's fascinating to me that the first principle here is non-attachment to views. Right? It's kind of diametrically opposite to the kind of fundamental principles of most, if not all, religions. It's kind of very interesting, isn't it? The second, which I think again is wonderful, and again, please understand that Thich Nhat Hanh, as I said this last week, please understand he founded this order and he developed this order of interbeing with the 14 trainings and this charter of it in a Buddhist, primarily Buddhist society. He wouldn't be stating this if this wasn't a direct not attack, but that he didn't have in mind the state of Vietnamese Buddhism, because when he wrote this, he was not a world citizen the way he is now, right? He was a Vietnamese monk, enmeshed in the Vietnamese Buddhist culture, and he was a monk, so he was very much in the Buddhist hierarchy. So for him to state this, I think he's also speaking very much to his own religious tradition at the time. So the first one is non-attachment to views. But he's very clear, of course, that he's going back to the original teachings of the Buddha. So his second one, again, just following up on what I just said about, if you think about, you know, fundamental principles of a religious community, the first one is non-attachment to view, and the second is direct experimentation. So you see how they follow one another. If your views are not dogma, are not truth, are not catechism, are not absolute, right? then it would follow then there's a lot of freedom to what? To experiment. And so he says, Buddhism emphasizes the direct experience of reality, not speculative philosophy. Direct practice realization, not intellectual research, brings about insight. Our own life is the instrument through which we experiment with truth. And this is quite profound. So let us spend a little time trying to understand this. So the second principle is direct. Buddhism emphasizes direct experience of reality, not speculative philosophy. Now this is coming back to the prior one where he said that this order looks to the Zen tradition, and it comes out of that tradition. And again, what I said to you earlier was when Zen came to China and developed in China, already Buddhism was well established as a religious, ritualistic, devotional, philosophical tradition. All that stuff was there. And what the Zen tradition did hundreds of years after Buddhism was established was saying, yeah, that's all good, right? That's all good. It's not like that. That's bad. And all those more traditional trappings of a religious tradition are not at the essence what Buddhism is about. Buddhism is not about philosophical speculation, intellectual discussion, reading and discussing. It's about realization. And where does this realization occur? In our own life. Right? So please understand what this means. I mean, this means many things. But what this means is when you encounter, and I'm sure everybody here, how many people have more than 10 books on Buddhism? Come on, Alex, I know you've got more than 10. How many have more than 20? 30? 40? Yeah, all right. So I'm talking to people who are very habituated, enjoy reading about Dharma, reading about spirituality, reading books that have lots of good meanings, right? As well as how many people enjoy talking with people about these matters. Anybody here enjoy talking to other people about these matters? Come on, Alex, you've got a minute. We're calling you out today. It is only direct practice realization, not intellectual research, that brings about insight. Our own life is the instrument through which we experiment with truth. So please understand what this is saying. This is saying to all of us, yes, it is wonderful. It is wonderful that you read books that deal with meaningful things about life. It is wonderful that you come and participate in a community and you hear Dharma talks, etc., etc. But this is all in the service of this very personal experimentation that each of us should be doing, which is what? Taking these teachings into our own life and experimenting with them to see if they are valid. Again, this is so radical for a religious view, right? Because most religions tell you what? And I'm not critical, I'm just saying it's just interesting. Say, this is truth, and your job is to what? Believe in it. Right? And this is saying, you know, even the truths of Buddhism, the truths of Buddhism, I don't say the truth of Buddhism, the truths of Buddhism, right? Because Buddhism does have its views, as you've all known from reading and hearing talks. I'm always presenting a view about things. But your job is to what? Is to say, let me take that view, that idea, and take it into my life and experiment with it to see if it is true, if it really works, right? And only then do you really adopt it as your view. Because now your view is not just coming out of intellectual speculative philosophy, it's coming out of what? Your own experience. You know it's true, right? So it's if I say to Candace, Candace said, Fred, you know a good place to eat? And I said, well, I heard, you know, there's a new restaurant that opened up, and I heard, or I think, you know, well, why don't you go try it? You know, I heard some good things about it, right? You know, many times we've done that and it's been a disaster, okay, our recommendations, okay? But if I've gone to this restaurant and I've eaten there and I really feel the food is delicious, then when I say to Candace, well, you know, I don't know if you'll like it, but I went to this restaurant and I really thought it was really delicious food, well prepared, right? Now there's a truth in what I say. It's not true, but it's true for me. And when I share that with somebody else, they know that someone's speaking from their own experience, right? And that is so essential, because we know that there is so much being passed around these days that we're just passing one view to another view. We're exchanging views. We're exchanging concepts. We're exchanging ideas. We're exchanging hearsay. We are not exchanging our own direct experience. And for this spiritual life to be really meaningful to us, we have to be willing to experiment with these truths and to see if they really work in our life. And then when we go to another human being and we say, yeah, the practice of mindfulness, the practice of meditation, the practice of concentration really helps one become more peaceful, right? Because one knows it from one's own life. It helps you to calm down. Yeah, the practice of non-attachment views really has made me a more open person. I find, you know, that I am just more open as I go about life and as I interchange with, you know, my children and my partner and my this and my that, and I listen to the news, I find that I am much more open and more peaceful. I'm not as upset. I don't get, oh. And since I practice meditation, I feel more grounded. I feel more stable. Oh, okay. So now when we talk with somebody else, we are talking from our own experience. And that has a validity. You know, speaking about communication, it's like people say, to acknowledge somebody else's feelings is not saying they're true. Right? Somebody said, well, you know, you know, for example, if you said to somebody, I understand that you're angry with me, right? That doesn't mean, that's not acknowledging that the reasons they're angry are accurate, right? It may be based on a total misperception. It may be based on a total projection, right? They're just making it up. It's a story they got in their head, it's causing them to be angry. But to say to someone, you know, I understand that you're angry is just validating to them what? That they're feeling is what they're feeling. There's no right or wrong in that. But it is acknowledging to the human being, yes, your feelings are your feelings. And they have a relative truth, which means they are what you're feeling right now. Our own life is the instrument through which we experiment with truth. Again, please, that's a wonderful concept, isn't it? Right? to see your body, your life, your relationships, everything you do, you are experimenting with truth. And it's all in the service, right, of what he calls here practice realization. And practice realization is hyphenated. Which is another important concept. Most of us often are very much into you know, we are success oriented, right? We do this to get that. I practice so I can one day awake, right? I practice loving kindness meditation so one day I can be a kind, loving person. Can you see we are dualistic? We separate cause and effect. We do this, 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 so we can get that. We don't realize that it is the doing of this, this, and this that we become that. They are not separate. It is by practicing loving kindness that I become a kind person. It's not that I practice, 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 and one day wake up a kind person. No, I practice. I am practicing. The practice of being mindful is the realization of mindfulness in my life. It's not like I practice, 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 and then one day over there, I'll wake up and I'll be a mindful person. No, it's the practice is the realization. That's why we say in this tradition, practice and realization are endless, because they are the same. Is that clear? So this is very important. Direct practice realization brings about our insight. Our own life is the instrument through which we experiment with truth. Now the third principle, he says, is appropriateness. So the first two have to do with either us as individual or a community as it practices together, this non-attachment to view and direct experimentation. The third one really has to do with how the teachings and the practices are shared. It says, a teaching, in order to bring about understanding and compassion, must reflect the needs of people and the realities of society. To do this, it must meet two criteria. It must conform with the basic tenets of Buddhism, and it must be truly helpful and relevant. It is said that there are 84,000 Dharma doors through which one can enter Buddhism. For Buddhism to continue as a living source of wisdom and peace, even more doors should be open. And one might think, gee, with 84,000 doors already being open, you know, isn't that enough? And Thich Nhat Hanh says, no. There are always more doors to be open. Why? Because of this statement of appropriateness. And this is very traditional in Buddhism, that any teaching to be beneficial needs to be appropriate to the needs of that individual human being or human beings, and appropriate to the realities of society, which means culture, time, right, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It has to be appropriate. So teachings in themselves are not absolute things, but have to be appropriate. And he said they must conform with the basic tenets of Buddhism and be helpful and relevant. So in other words, now when we say Buddhism, of course, we're talking about practices and teachings that have been experimented with, right? They have been experimented with, so they have a certain coherent validity, right? That's Buddhism. it's not just a set of abstract philosophical or religious dogmatic principles. It is something that has been experimented with. So on the one hand, it must conform to this basic outlook and view and teachings of Buddhism. And at the same time, it must be helpful and relevant. And again, please understand that we can think about this in the big term, but we can think about this in terms of what? Just helping another human being. Again, so when we want to help another human being, there is a place that we are coming from. When we approach this situation with this other human being. And we could say that is our Buddhism. Right? But what does that mean? It means a certain way we understand the human situation, a certain way we see what causes suffering, a certain way the way we see how the mind operates and how that relates to suffering, a certain way we look at what really produces true well-being or happiness. So we're coming to the situation with a certain kind of view that we've experimented with so that we're not just blind, right? There is something in this encounter with this other human being that we want to benefit in some way. We have a framework in which we are approaching it. And of course, he says, we want to be helpful. We are not, again, we are not coming into that situation where we want to help another human being with a set of dogmas, with a set of truth, with already a sense of how we want this person to be. No, we want to help them. And we want to help them in terms of what? Of where they're at. Not where we're at, and not how we think they should be, and not how we think the world should be, right? But we are actually present to this human being as they are in their situation, in their suffering, the whole matrix of this human being. It's that we are attentive to, and we want our intervention to be appropriate to them, but also within the framework of being helpful and meaningful. And in the context of these greater views of Buddha Dharma, we're not just holding on to views, but they're actually our principles that we live by. So these two points, and the next point is what he calls skillful means. So what simply it means in any situation, whether as a community, a religious community, we want to make an intervention in the broader society, or whether as an individual, we want to make an intervention with another human being, we want it to be appropriate to the situation, and we want our intervention to be skillful. Right? There may be many of us here who say, well, I think I have some capacity. I understand this person. I can understand their life. I understand the nature of their addiction. You know what I'm saying? I understand what's causing them to suffer. I understand what happened in their childhood and how that's managed. You know what I'm saying? So we kind of get that. But if anybody has ever intervened with people, we may not always be skillful, right? Which means it may not work. We may not be that helpful. We may be off the mark. So this idea of skillfulness has to do with some sense of what? Not only understanding and intellectual discriminating wisdom, but some kind of competency, right? Skillfulness implies competency. How does one become competent or skillful at something?
Practice.
So again, it's very interesting. Again, if you think about these teachings about appropriate and skillful means, go back to the Buddha's time. I mean, they're thousands of years old in terms of how practitioners help beings. And yet we know in our modern age, right, There may be people in here who are healthcare professionals, mental health professionals, other type of professionals, and you might have learned that you need to develop what? Skillfulness? We have practicums, we have internships, we study, so we become skillful at what we do, right? You just don't read the books and go out there and help people, right? Anybody notice that? So the idea that somehow you have a framework in which you're approaching situations, and that you have the capacity of understanding the situation that you're dealing with, and that you're skillful in your intervention, so you really are helpful and not harmful, or else are just doing nothing, is ancient. People have been trying to liberate people from their suffering for thousands of years. And I can only speak about Buddhism, but this is a tradition where that has been paramount. And yet you can see the ground of it is this non-attachment in view, this openness, and this willingness to directly experiment. Truth is not, there's a great quote in one of the, where Thay says, truth is not found in intellectual speculation. Truth is only found in life. And if we cannot see the truth of our ideas in life, then it's not much of a truth. Is that true? So this is very humbling, isn't it? But it's also, I think, a model for us as individual practitioners, as models for us as a community, because it allows us as a community in going forward to understand right from the beginning that we are not here to establish dogma. We are not here to get people to buy our truth. We are here to teach people a methodology of understanding themselves and of coming to the direct realization of their own truths. Right? So we present views, we present teachings, but it's just an invitation, right, to sample. Right? It's sort of like, again, if you're a cook, or you own a restaurant, you say, come on in, invite people, come, because I think I have really wonderful food here. But they're going to decide for themselves, right? I mean, we may think that we have a great cook and we have great food, but it may not be true, is it? People may come in and never come back. So that should be a wake-up call. If we are attached to our view that I have wonderful food, and yet people don't come back, then what? Then I am attached to a view and I am not experimenting, right? Because when I'm not attached to view, I put forward my sense that I have a delicious food in my restaurant as just it's transitional, right? And now I will experiment. I am open. And we should be that way in everything. And again, it doesn't mean we can't have value systems and belief systems and all that, but not with this tightly held sense of it's true, absolute truth. We don't know what's true, do we? Any questions before we end? We'll end the formal teaching. Any questions? Yes.
Realizing that you need to be skillful so you can help someone or some family members, mm-hmm. and realizing that if I may not be at that point, how would I go about trying to find someone or that I feel comfortable with that would be skillful in that, with a very dynamic situation?
I think, so the question is, if one is unsure about if one's skillful in this, in a situation like a family situation that is problematic, I think you would go, to somebody who at least publicly is recognized as having skill, knowledge and skill in that area. Right? There are many, many physical conditions that we may be able to take care of ourselves, right? But at a certain point, we realize the interventions that I've been doing, the things I've been reading and changing my diet or taking this or that, I still have this significant problem. At that point, we may what? Seek out people who are specialists in those areas, and whether that's physical health, mental health, whether that's law, whether that's our cars and electrical issues in our homes and plumbing issues in our homes, right? I mean, to me, it's all the same thing. There may be a capacity that each of us have to develop skill in an area, but it's also good to be humble and to know where our skill, has reached its optimal point. And the problem still persists, and rather than continuing to bang, it's good to go, let me step back and I need help. And I think in a certain way to acknowledge I need help is a wonderful statement of our interdependence. To think that I have to have all the answers really in a certain way is very egocentric and very alone. I think an acknowledgement of interconnection and interbeing is to go, certain things I know and certain things I don't know. Certain things I can do myself and certain things I need the help of others. And it's all easy. There's no, I got something wrong with me for not knowing more. I should, It's people have that. But to me, that's just ego. We should be open and it's good to ask for help. Especially when we don't know better. I think entering a spiritual path for many of us is that. Right? We realize that all our attempts by ourselves to effect the transformation and healing that we want or to become the kind of person that we think and hope we can be, by ourselves we haven't been able to do it. I need help. I need the help of a teacher. I need the help of good teaching, I need the help and support of the community. To me that's not an acknowledgement of failure. I think that's smart. And I think a free person can ask for help. And we should, it's good to depend on one another. Isn't that what we're here for? A lot of people have hang-ups about asking help from others. But to me that's a hang-up. It's an ego. I mean, each of us, I think if we're honest with ourselves, would say what? I need all the help I can get. That's the truth. I need all the help I can get. And again, when you say that to yourself, then you're what? Then you're open. I need all the help I can get, so I'm gonna look around and get some help. I don't have to do it all by myself. Wow, that's... to me that's a great relief. When you think you got to do it all by yourself and you should have all the answers and you should be where you think you should be all by yourself, that's stupid. Because we've only gotten ourselves where we are today because we've always relied on ourselves. So we need kind of a little outside expertise. An outside consultant to look at this mess. And they maybe have some objectivity about because most of us don't have objectivity about ourselves. It's not easy to be objective. That's one of the things we learn through our meditation, to be more objective. But to be able to be objective and to be able to seek help and good help is good. So good. So we'll stop here.